Okay, my name is Dr. Howard Smith, and I'm a community engagement specialist with mining, oil and gas industry. I have a background of 25 years in the mining industry and 8 years at the Northern Land Council dealing specifically with getting technical concepts across to Aboriginal people.
Howard, you have a very great amount of experience in dealing with mining companies and Aboriginal communities. What kind of advice would you give Aboriginal traditional owners when they encounter mining companies looking for mineral resources on their lands?
I think probably one of the first bits of advice I give to people is to deal with it fairly and treat it as an opportunity, because while there won't be much happening during exploration phase, should it proceed to a mine or an oil or gas production, there will be a lot of financial benefit that comes from it. Too often people get caught up too much in the environmental side of things. Now, I'm not saying that's not important, because they are very important and these things have to be considered in the mix. But quite often, a lot of other opportunities slip by unnoticed if people focus just on one thing too much over the rest of it.
Mm. So, is the first step if someone came and knocked on your door and said, "Oh, you know, I want to come out. Could you take me out to your homelands? I want to see, you know, see whether we want to drill." Would a memorandum of understanding be the first step, or would someone just say yes, you can go out and do that? What would you say to them?
I think the first step, and it's probably the most important step, is to just generate this dialogue. So you wouldn't necessarily need to have a formal memorandum of understanding in the first instance, but it's very important that you would take out the company executives, for instance, and show them around the land to give them an appreciation of what it means to people.
Yeah.
Of how they use it, how they live on it, because you have to remember that a lot of CEOs don't understand this because they don't have these opportunities to come out and have a look at it. And once they've experienced this and gone out and interacted with people, interacted with the environment, seen how it all works, then you're in a position to put together a more formal and experience-based memorandum of understanding and start working towards a proper agreement.
Mm, but most people don't get a CEO knocking on their door. They'll get someone who's usually a nice person who gets on quite well with Aboriginal people, and they'll say, "Oh, come on, old man, come out on country. We want to just, go out and you could show us where your lands are," or, you know, something like that. So what do people do in that kind of situation?
Well, I think in those situations you just sort of have to deal with whoever is there in the first instance and just try and get the message back to the upper echelons that, look, you know, we are important people in this process. We are technically the members of the board that speak for the clan group or for the land, and it's right and it's appropriate that people higher up in the company also come out and engage. In the Northern Territory, this does happen quite a lot.
Mm.
And it does make the whole process a lot easier, and it gives people this sort of sense of pride as well, because where the veto right can come into play, they feel good in themselves if they're encouraged to, for the senior men themselves or the senior women, the senior people in the Aboriginal culture, to actually give their formal response to the senior person in the organisation, because it's culturally appropriate to Aboriginal people that it should be done that way. And it's perfectly acceptable to the businesses that are coming here looking for it.
Mm. So in other words, they would then understand that the veto that would be exercised by TO is justified and understandable, in that it may be a sacred area or something like that. In fact, I was sitting around the campfire this morning and I was hearing a story about how a senior man had told a mining company that if you go into that area, it's very dangerous, and of course some bad things happen. So that is a classic example of what not to do, isn't it?
Well, that's a very good example of what not to do. And had the company, you know, been a bit more sensitive to this, a bit more aware of these things, and I don't know their personal circumstances, and perhaps spent a lot more time getting out there with people and trying to understand what the whole nature of these things, because us as European people, we quite often like to break things down into little parts to try and understand and then put it all back together again, and you don't always get the jigsaw puzzle right, of course, whereas Aboriginal people come from is this more holistic sort of view, and it's often beneficial, yes, for the senior people in the company to come out and see all of this, and hopefully they can develop the same sort of understanding and not run into these sorts of problems.
And what should be in a... So we reached the memorandum of understanding stage. What should be in a memorandum of understanding?
I think the most important thing in the memorandum of understanding is a commitment of both parties to work together towards a common sort of outcome. And the common sort of outcome would be things that are specifically put into agreements. Okay, the agreement with the mining company or with the oil company, both at exploration stage and especially at production stage.
So is there any examples of good agreements that have been, you know, reached around... Well, we're coming on to the oil and gas, which is, I know, one of your major interests at the moment. So what would a good memorandum of understanding and where would it lead to? Can you give us any examples that are around the place that are not confidential?
Okay, I don't know of any real memorandums of understanding here in the Northern Territory. There is one that I know of, and that was there.
Is that because they're usually confidential documents?
Yeah, usually they're confidential documents.
Yeah.
But down at Yulpera, there were some discussions between a company that wanted to do undersea mining and the local people.
Yeah.
Now, the essence of the memorandum of understanding was all about, yes, we want to help you develop your community, want to help your children have a future and your grandchildren have a future, but our commitment is that we will still follow the legal requirements, and in this case it means that irrespective of what we talk about amongst ourselves, we will still go through the Northern Land Council to come up with the formal agreement that's required by law. The company was not seeking to sidestep the legislation or anything, but just to sort of start developing this firm and strong relationship with the landowners so that should they be in a position in the future to do the mining or to do the work of any sort, then they had a strong base and strong community support from which they could work.
I was just thinking this is a really appropriate topic for the 50th anniversary of the Bard petition, isn't it? Because, you know, of course, that was the worst case example of all, wasn't it, in many ways?
Well, that's right. You know, the history here, of course, with the Gove project, and it's all out there available for the public to read and understand about, was that it was a conflict over land ownership. The Aboriginal people here, of course, had their own formal system of ownership of land, but the European people couldn't recognise or understand it. So in the end, the legislation was basically passed to say, well, okay, the mine can go ahead, and the company that does it will then have to sit down and negotiate an agreement. Unfortunately, that company never did that.
Yeah.
And it had to sort of wait until some 40 years later before the agreement was negotiated. But of course, the 50th anniversary here of the panels, the Bart paintings, the church panels, and the petition was all about, hey, this is our land, this needs to be recognised in some way. The preference at the time, of course, was not to have mining. That's my understanding of it, that people did not want the mine. Essentially, it was sort of forced upon them, and over the last 40 years people have come to live with it, but it really was an important part of the Northern Territory's process, because ultimately it was one of the initial triggers for the Land Rights Act.
And that Land Rights Act is the reason why we have this situation where companies do have to come and talk to traditional owners and ask their permission.
That's correct, because under the Land Rights Act, Aboriginal people here have essentially communal freehold ownership of land, which even though the Crown owns the minerals beneath that land, the people here recognise as owners of the land, so you have to come and negotiate an agreement for access to what's below the land.
Yeah.
And the Aboriginal people, because they have the freehold rights, have the right to veto a project should they wish to do so.
Mm. So Howard, you've now, you know, you've worked for the Northern Land Council for 8 years, and you're now out working in the marketplace. And I know oil and gas is an area that you're very interested in, and you're trying to make sure that there are good agreements and good relationships between Yolngu people in northeast Arnhem Land and companies interested in exploration in this area. But so what is the situation with gas and oil, and what are the big issues that are facing northeast Arnhem Land that you see?
All right, well, at the moment in northeast Arnhem Land, people here are progressive, but they're also conservative. So, and because they have the right to veto the land, of course, yes, then they're in a strong position to make sure that what they feel is the right thing is being done. Obviously, one of the biggest issues at the moment is this hydraulic fracturing stuff, or fracking as people call it. And we have to be very careful with this, because there's a lot of information out there, there's a lot of misinformation out there, and there's a lot of confusion amongst things, because there's two sorts of processes that are happening here. There's the coal seam gas, which is terrifically difficult to do. Well, yeah, it's not difficult to do technically, but it's terrifically difficult to control environmentally, because you do run the risk there of getting gas into the water bodies, the drinking water supplies, if you don't build your wells properly, if you don't have it technically up to standard. But there's also the shale gas industry, where the oil and gas is extracted from shale, but it's much deeper down, yeah, and it's not where the drinkable water is. And comparatively, the shale oil production is perhaps technically more difficult, but safer than the coal seam gas.
Right.
And unfortunately at the moment, because there's a lot of public debate about coal seam gas, it's also carrying over into the shale gas.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is important to the Northern Territory, because there are few, if any, known coal seams here. So if people do not understand these things properly, they may well veto or decide not to go down the path of shale oil, shale gas production, which of course is their right if,
yeah,
they wish to, but in doing that they may miss out on an opportunity that arises. And right at the start I think I said that yes, there are environmental concerns, but people have to weigh those carefully against the potential opportunities for the future. In short, with regards to oil and gas generation, it's really all about how good the construction of your well is.
Yeah.
If you build a bad well that leaks, it doesn't matter what you do underneath it, whether it's a conventional production or whether you're doing hydraulic fracturing, you will pollute the water. If you build a good well, it's fine.
Yeah.
All the gas, all the oil will come up through the well, it will be captured and it will be produced. And obviously that's a very lucrative market, especially for Aboriginal people, because it's possible to put into the agreements here as some sort of an equity or some sort of a royalty payment, which is literally worth hundreds of millions of dollars a year for the landowning groups.
Right. So you went to the United States, Howard, last year, I think it was. Or was it last year? That seems
2 years ago.
2 years ago. And you surveyed all of the bad situations with some of these... And in every case, and of course they've made spectacular news headlines, and oil wells as well in, you know, Louisiana obviously, and down on the Gulf of, is it the Gulf of Mexico?
Gulf of Mexico.
And so it is a really bad press out there around a lot of these issues. Is in every case the situation that shortcuts were taken technically, or were some of those situations that you looked at a case of this just should never have been done, and we need to take some lessons back home about where
there's a lot of reasons why there's bad press out there, and yes, there are certain lessons that can be taken back to Australia. I had a look at the situation in Pennsylvania, which is I think where Gasland was produced.
Yeah.
And one of the problems there is that
there's
a lot of coal seam,
yeah,
gas. It's already in the water table. But it's also compounded by the fact that there's close to 500,000 existing old
mines.
Boreholes for gas,
right,
for extracting gas. And these date back 100, 150 years.
Yeah.
Okay, since people first moved into Pennsylvania, because they observed gas was coming out of the ground. And they said, well, basically, we can just put a pipe straight down into the ground and stick a little burner on the top of it, and we have gas. We have power, we have lights, we have all of this. But in those days, the environmental standards were nothing like they are today. And a lot of these holes have no casings. They when they've sort of run out of gas or oil, then when they were closed was simply rolling a rock across the top of it or poking a tree stump down it, and that doesn't seal the hole. And this is all compounded by the understanding that nobody knows where most of these holes are either. They were never recorded in those days, so you're really looking at a 150 year old legacy, and there's still gas there. So the modern companies come along and said, okay, we've since developed this hydraulic fracturing or the fracking process, and it works really well, but because it's working, it works really well now, we can frack in this area. But because they don't know where these holes are, if you frack next to a bunch of open holes, well, obviously your gas or oil is going to go into those holes and come to the surface and into the water. Now, we don't have that problem in Australia.
Right.
We certainly don't have it in the Northern Territory. There's at best some 300 drill holes across the whole of the Northern Territory. And the chance of encountering one that hasn't been closed properly is minimal compared to Pennsylvania. Now, one of the other things that doesn't seem to be coming across in the press is that in North Dakota, they've been doing this fracking for 40, 50 years, and to my knowledge, there has never been an adverse report. Okay, so you really have to take each one according to, you know, the circumstances behind what's been happening.
The situation in the Northern Territory, and you know, we're also talking about the Pilbara, is a similar situation where there isn't so much coal seam gas. It's shale.
Yeah, that's correct.
So there's a much easier process for extracting gas. Is that right?
Well, it's not easier. It's actually quite difficult because you have to deal with the pressures of the rocks 2 kilometres underground. And how the gas and oil is captured in this rock is many, many years ago when the sediments were being laid down and all the organic matter was laid down amongst it. This is, you know, way back in the times of the dinosaurs and things like that. And, of course, you've had all this sedimentation on top of it, and that creates temperature and pressure at depth. And the organic matter that was caught in there, it turns into tiny droplets of oil.
Yeah.
And over time, it matures and becomes gas. Depending, the longer it's down there, the more gasification that you occur. But the pores of the rock, the shale itself, are so small, and the rock is so tightly compacted that if you punch a well into it, it's not going to come out, even though it's under pressure. It's all sort of held in there. In comparison to a conventional play, you've got a lot more porous rock, and it's under pressure. And the moment you puncture it, it comes out like, you know, air out of a balloon. If you stick a pin in there, it will just come straight out. So what you have to do with the shale is actually come down, find where the deposit is, turn the drill horizontal, and drill along maybe 2-3 kilometres, and pump down water and sand under a lot of high pressure. Some companies use chemicals, and that is a concern, but I understand that there is a process where they can use what they call slick water to do this, and the main constituent of that is just water and sand, so it's chemically benign. Okay, so what you do is you crack the rocks open, and extract the water out of it. The sand is designed to sit in those cracks and sort of keep the cracks open. And the oil and gas, because it is still under pressure, is a bit freer, and it migrates through the cracks into the hole, and it comes up under pressure, and that's how they produce it. So technically it's a little bit more difficult, or it's a quite a technical process, but it's not impossible to do it.
Right. Okay, so can you What are people interested in Northeast Arnhem Land at the moment in terms of oil and gas, and which companies, and how likely is it that there's, for example, oil going to be found around this region?
Okay, well, I can't necessarily tell you which companies are here because it's still very much subject to exploration at the moment. And no land has been granted, but there is interest here from several junior companies, but the junior companies have larger affiliates overseas, you know, the larger companies like the Shells and the Essos and big multinational companies. So the future would probably be the smaller company would do the exploration and at some point sell out if it proceeds. Amongst Indigenous people, there is a lot of interest here because they can see a future and they can see a future for their children. In terms of likelihood of finding oil and gas, well, I'm not a petrogeologist, so I really can't say. But all I do know is that some 200 kilometres to the west, near Gapawiak, the same shale deposits that they see down at Newcastle Waters actually come to the surface. Now, at Newcastle Waters, there is a very large deposit of oil and gas has been identified in these rocks. It's unlikely to be present near Gapawiak because they're so much closer to the surface and whatever gas was in there has probably long gone. But nobody knows what's beneath it. Okay, so there could well be more sedimentary deposits containing oil or gas beneath it. To the east in the Gulf of Carpentaria, that's been fairly well surveyed seismically. People know there's a sedimentary basin, and there's only ever been one hole drilled, and that came up dry. So the jury's still out on that one, basically. Just because you drill a hole in the basin, it's dry, doesn't mean the whole of the basin is dry. So, and directly underneath Gove itself, well, really one doesn't know because there's been no oil and gas exploration here.
Well, that's a very interesting thing to be thinking about for the future. Thanks so much, Howard, for your time today.
Pleasure's mine. What's happening over there?